All right, you've got it on KHUM, Cutting, Eureka, Arcata, and Ferndale, and streaming on the web at khum.com, and translator K282AD Ferndale. So, it is time. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. The topic we are dealing with is a pretty broad and timely topic: privilege, prejudice, power, and the violence of otherism. And it is now time for our two-hour panel discussion. We've got a terrific panel of folks here in the studio, and this is a chance also for you to call in and get in on the conversation, ask a question, make a comment. That number is 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. This is, believe it or not, our 20th Stop the Violence campaign, as incredible as that may seem. And we should introduce everyone around the room. We'll start off with my co-host for the past 20 years, Sherry Johnson.
Good morning, everybody. I am employed as the Director of Field Education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and a board member of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council. And to my left,
Nezzy Wade. I'm currently engaged in a number of activities, one of which is AHA, Affordable Homeless Housing Alternatives. I'm on the board there, the president of the board. And I'm also on the Human Rights Commission and currently chair of the commission for Humboldt County.
Good morning. I'm Paula Arrowsmith-Jones, and I'm with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team and also a board member of the Domestic Violence Coordinating Council.
And I'm Bill Damiano, chief probation officer for the County of Humboldt and also the vice chair of the Domestic Violence Coordinating Council. Thanks, Cliff.
You bet. We got quite a good panel here. This is quite the panel. Yesterday, we had Jennifer Eichsted, who is, of course, the department chair at Humboldt State for sociology, mm-hmm. and she was fantastic. We spoke about white privilege for the most part, and yeah, you had a chance to listen to that. It was quite the conversation.
Yeah.
Quite the conversation. So, a lot of things to talk about. In fact, so much so that we're doing this over the next, we're doing this over 2 weeks. We're taking on this subject even more next week, and then kind of looking at solutions and whatnot, as we always like to do. So, where to start? I mean,
It is very big.
One thing that you mentioned, Sherry, that I think I'd like to just like kind of throw out there is the difference between bias and prejudice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's like, so what are those definitions?
Well, we can look at definitions that we sort of inherit, you know, from the dictionary. But it's really important, I think, for us to think about that as in real life and have examples given by people on the panel. But just really simple, real simple. We'll go with prejudice as judgment in advance. And bias is also a synonym for bias is prejudice. But it's in prejudice in favor of or against one thing, person, or group compared with another, usually in a way considered to be unfair. But I think we're going to use those interchangeably. It depends on the actual lived experience of someone, whether they feel that they're experiencing prejudice or bias. Well, all we know is it doesn't feel good. So whatever word that you want to use to choose to describe it. Cambridge Dictionary, what is bias? The action of supporting or opposing a particular person or thing in an unfair way. What is prejudice? An unfair and unreasonable opinion or feeling, especially when formed without enough information. So there we go.
Okay. it's a good place. It's a good place to start. That is for sure. And since we unfortunately missed having you here, Paula, earlier in the week, I want to jump right in and talk about some of the stuff that is right up your street, you know, and that is sexualized violence. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing, as we have talked about over the years numerous times, is not about sex per se. It's not about, not at all about love. It is about power. And this is often done by otherizing the victim.
That's right. I mean, it's almost solely about power, and not just power, but power over, power at someone's expense, and control of another. And in order to do that, objectifying that person, seeing them as less than a whole human being, is one of the ways that the perpetrator of that violence can rationalize to themselves that what they're doing is okay or not so bad, because they're not really allowing themselves to think about the emotional impact, sometimes long-term emotional impacts of what they're doing to somebody. If you don't see them as a somebody,
right,
but a something, then it's easier to dismiss them.
You know, because a rational person would say, how could one person do this kind of thing to another? And mm-hmm. that is one of the answers.
Well, and we're all encouraged and taught that. If you think about media images that take bodies and fragment them and put them out there as if they're something to purchase, and if you mix sex and violence in images, and if you think of sex as a thing to get, so it's like it's free-floating outside of a human, that's, you know, we're all inundated with all of those messages and images, so it's not surprising that some people then would integrate that so deeply in themselves that they can justify what they're doing. And I'm not in any way saying that there's an excuse for violence. Violence is a choice. It's just that I think that rapists and batterers and child abusers are created, and that we all have a part in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that I think we need to also make clear is, you know, we were talking about prejudice and privilege. And yesterday we talked a lot about white privilege and whatnot. But the one thing that we should talk about also is that there is also prejudice against women. I mean, this is this is better than 50% of the population. This is not a minority, but women often fall into this category of the other, of a prejudice, and again, allowing for this kind of violence.
Well, and really, when we think, and it's really interesting when you kind of put the historical glasses on, when we look through that lens. I mean, in 1920, we were then able to vote. Mm-hmm. So we weren't even legal entities until 1920. That's not that all that long ago.
No.
So we were considered property, just like, you know, property. So that's
like my iPhone.
Yeah, right. The obvious objectification. I mean, we really were not human beings in the eyes of the law. So, and then it's just only in the last, you know, 30, 40 years that you would say he or she. Mm-hmm. Before, it was always he or mankind, and that subsumed women and girls. You know, you had to think, did that apply to me too? Or man meant everybody. Mm-hmm. So really, we're just little babies, really. We're just infants in the development of consciousness around people as legal and sentient human beings. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, there's all that historical stuff that gets brought almost like epigenetically, you know, in our ancestors' genes and our genes and our stories and our family stories and the way great-grandmothers were treated and the way mothers were treated and the way daughters now are treated as well. So we've inherited a lot of those family patterns, and at the same time, the resistance, the ability to have voice, to have choice, to have options, to have alternatives, that's caused a disruption in the sort of the, you know, a homeostasis or the balance of how family power was exercised. Here we are now looking at, you know, huge, huge resistance worldwide of girls just trying to get education. Malala is an excellent example, and now a leader worldwide to just even the simplest thing of saying, I want to learn how to read.
And if you take a look at this in the context of what we talked about yesterday, as far as privilege, let's substitute white privilege to male privilege.
Absolutely.
Because there is a huge privilege for being male.
And one thing can't exist without the other. So in order, as soon as you have a group or class of people that's pushed down, that is to some other group's advantage, and that privilege that exists isn't the fault of any individual. So if we're talking about male privilege, it's not an individual male's fault that they were born into this system.
Thank goodness.
Any more than it's a woman's fault that she's born into this. It is, however, I think any of us who hold privilege, and most of us hold some form of privilege, or many of us do, to look at it, look ourselves in the mirror, and challenge ourselves not to maintain that status quo and not to take advantage of that privilege. So it can be hard to look at that sometimes. And I meet especially young men, at say, in a college class. They don't feel like they're holding privilege when they compare themselves to older men, slightly older men, who are in positions of authority over them. And yet, if you looked at any group of people, take any oppressed group, if you looked at the gender issues within that, you would probably find still a difference in status, putting women and children at the bottom. So sometimes, you know, a person has to be willing to really look at that and say, I might be a member of an oppressed group simultaneously with being a member of a group of privilege. And what do I do about that?
No, that's an excellent point right there, that you can be in two columns, and depending on circumstances, you know, fall on one side or the other. And one thing that we talked about yesterday was the fact that so many people say, oh, I am not bigoted. I am not prejudiced. You know, I am not biased. However, their actions show something different. And, you know, the same can be said when we were talking about male privilege, is that, oh, no, we're completely not biased. However, if you take a look at the statistics in the workplace, there is an absolute bias. There's no doubt about it. It is not even a question mark.
Yeah. Well, and if that wasn't true, it wouldn't be true that overwhelmingly sexualized violence is acted out against women. If their gender wasn't an issue and everyone was the same, then the statistics would look really different.
Absolutely.
Well, the same is certainly reflected in the justice system, or criminal justice system, where there's disparity in people of color are overrepresented in the system. Certainly it's difficult for offenders. I'm in the corrections business, and it's all about trying to help offenders to become productive citizens and change their ways and become less criminal, and they need opportunities. But a majority of the community, the people that hold privilege or power, meaning jobs and those kinds of stations in life that will help these people change, are reticent to bring those offenders into their businesses, into their properties, places to live, and it makes it really challenging. So, you know, a big part of my role is to go out and try and educate the community about it's a community that needs to respond, and we have to provide opportunities for offenders to be able to change. If they don't have an opportunity to work in a job, they don't have an opportunity to live with a roof over their head, that we actually keep them down and actually make them more likely to commit crimes or continue to commit crimes. They have to have a chance to change.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've opened up the door to a whole other line of things that we need to discuss. But first, we need to take a quick break. I want to remind folks that this is an open community dialogue, and you are certainly welcome to be part of it. The phone number is 786-KHUM at 786-5486. You don't have to give your name if you'd like, and there's not a whole bunch of operators standing by. It's just me, so if you get it ringing while we're talking, just let it ring until we get a chance to answer it. If you would like to just email a question, studio@khum.com. All right, it is 21 minutes after 8 o'clock. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues here on KHUM. We are dealing with privilege, prejudice, power, and the violence of otherism. And again, let me give the phone number. You are certainly welcome to be part of the conversation, 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. Studio at KHUM.com. If you would like to send in a question via email, we're certainly open to that. So, Bill Damiano was just talking a little bit about the justice system and whatnot, which brings up something that has kind of the main reason why we chose this topic, because it has been so much so prevalent in the news. Not necessarily here in Humboldt County, but it has been so prevalent in the news, where we have police officers interacting with unarmed black men and having them die. I mean, this is just a bizarre thing. It seems to be happening a lot. And you know, one thing I was is an interesting conversation I was having with Amy last night at dinner is I was saying, you know, we've got two boys, and this is a conversation that we did not have, but we would have if they were black, is, you know, at a very young age, we would let them know, you know, if you ever encounter a police officer, make sure you make no sudden moves, make sure you're very polite, make sure your hands are visible. Many people I know of color have that conversation with their children. And this is a conversation I never had with our white kids. Mm-hmm. And it's just an interesting thing going on in this country.
Well, there's a lot of othering there all over the place, mm-hmm. not just with race, but with classes of people. Like law enforcement officers are also othered.
Sure.
And it makes it difficult for us to do our job. Not all cops are bad.
Most aren't.
Yeah, and we have a pretty huge responsibility, and it's difficult going into certain neighborhoods and certain crime-plagued areas to try and bring peace and solve crimes and get cooperation from the populace. And again, it's still takes a lot of work from agencies and officials to reach out to the community and become part of the community and open up dialogue and try and make sure they're removing the bias and showing their humanity. And I think that we see a lot of examples of that in the media as well. Where people go out of their way to show their humanity regardless of race and regardless of class and regardless of station.
I mean, it is unfortunate that a small, very small minority of police officers are the ones that are tainting, you know, an entire community. But mm-hmm. it has been happening and been happening a lot. And, of course, it's been in the news quite a bit. There was a story a few months back of a woman who was pulled over for a routine traffic stop, arrested, jailed, and died. And it was just amazing. This is one of those stories that I think a lot of us were just completely taken aback by it.
And we wouldn't have known about it, but because of social media and internet, and we're instantaneously able to access information, all kinds of information, and these kinds of stories have just really mounted up. The recent story about now documented sexual assault of by police officers of people, of women, girls and women, now being exposed, now being dealt with, now being addressed. But how long has that been going on? How much of that has happened? And mainly to poor women, mm-hmm. mainly to women of color, maybe mainly to sex workers, I would assume, also in that category. But these are definitely the categories of other. So it's behavior, and it's the institutional authority. When I used to teach the domestic violence unit with law enforcement, with Dave Douglas, actually, who became the captain, he was captain then, and then the police chief of Eureka City Police. And he would say the only color really we're looking at here is the color blue. And that was his attempt to help the cadets delineate between their authority, which was the color blue, and not to impose that authority in any kind of unjust way. But you're looking at years and years and years of conditioning. You're looking at the, you know, giving somebody a gun who maybe is not suited for that position of authority and power and control. Because that is the ultimate power and control.
Excuse me. I have a hard time sitting here and listening to the commentary about the police in a lot of respects. Because my familiarity is with the police locally for the last near 40 years. And I think that I've seen in policing everywhere in this country the ramping up of the militarization of domestic policing and things that have added and complicated, you know, our circumstances here. So I don't want to absolve the police of their responsibility for becoming more aggressive.
Sure.
Yeah. So I had to say that.
Yeah, yeah. And Nezzy, you're right. And in what has been in the news locally has been the issues of people living with, you know, without houses, and the response of city government and the police about that. And then the community has had its response, too.
Sure. Right. And probably in the near 40 years that I've lived here, this is probably the most aggravated I've seen our community. Humboldt County community. There is a lot of divisiveness and certainly vindictiveness all the way around for the situation of having so many transient and homeless people in our county.
Well, there is a bias that many people have that if you are poor, if you are homeless, you are a criminal, or you deserve it somehow, or you didn't work hard enough, or you didn't pull yourself up by your bootstraps, or something like that. The reality is, and having worked with Food for People for so long, we've been doing a long campaign with them, is that the reality is that, you know, there are so many people, especially here in Humboldt County, who live so close to the edge. You know, they are the working poor. You know, they work every day, go to work every day, but they're not making much money. They're barely making ends meet. One small thing, a car breaking down, a child getting sick, can just put you over the edge and make you homeless. Right. Happens all the time.
One of the things that I think is, in terms of otherizing, that's important, is when you otherize someone or see them as two-dimensional, it makes it difficult for you to see their humanity. And you don't see your own humanity either, which is why otherizing is damaging to everybody. But what happens, or what I see happening, is when you have a population that's disenfranchised already and they have no options, we really have no other place for people to go. We have inadequate sheltering. We don't have housing availability. And people are congregating in areas where it's illegal for them to be. We have anti-camping laws, no sit, no lie, no pee. People have no ability to take care of their needs. And I personally think the most violent thing that we do to people that are homeless is not providing them with some kind of safety where they can have legal sleep. Depriving someone of sleep is a form of torture in a lot of circles, and it's really a very violent thing. So people become very disoriented when they don't have stability, and it's been institutionalized now. So once it is institutionalized, then it's extremely difficult to see bias, because it's just the status quo. It's what's happening.
Well, you are absolutely right. I'm really glad that you're here today, because this is something that really needs to be addressed. It's a thing that's been swept under the rug, and it's one of the last forms of bias that seems to be pretty much socially acceptable. I mean, there's been a lot of stories about the encampments behind the mall and the raids, clearing them out and whatnot. And, you know, I look at the comments on our own Lost Coast Outpost from the people who make them, and it's just, it's treating these people as inhuman. And, you know, it's very easy to do when this is someone you don't know, when it's the other, when it's just those homeless bums that are, you know, in camping. But the reality is there is no legal recourse. I mean, it is illegal to be homeless because you cannot camp. It's not legal. You can't sleep in a doorway. You know, it's like what can you do? There are shelters, but there's really not enough to deal with that. And it's something that's kind of like not been addressed. It's the big elephant in the room.
Right. Well, and Sherry knows this because of the work that she does, and Paula too is in our, and probably Bill from the work that he does, that we have what's called a continuum of care that should be about food and housing and clothing and all the needs that people have, but it doesn't address some of the very basic needs that people have and being able to find accommodations for the real needs. Mm-hmm. And so because we have programs that are prescripted and people are eligible based on the mandate of the program, a lot of people can't get help right away. Mm-hmm. Or my phone number is on a lot of flyers that are out there. Mm-hmm. And I get telephone calls regularly from people who are previously professional, had working lives, even university lives, who are now homeless, that have mental health issues, cannot get help. You know, they can get help like getting a meal or getting a new pair of clothes to go out and get an interview or that kind of thing, but they can't really get what they need. And so that's a whole other conversation we could have about that.
And Bill, one thing we were talking off air, and I'd like to bring it into the conversation, is you were talking about that there's a lot of biasing that these people all back there are criminals.
Well, there's a perception of that, and it may turn out to be true that they're lower level criminals. They're petty crimes. There's a lot of municipal code violations, no doubt. There certainly is drug use and possession. Those are still crimes. But I think that there's a misperception that these are the guys that were sent to us from realignment. I've heard that comment repeatedly. And when mm-hmm. I look at the names of people contacted out there, there's a couple of them that are the ones that have been realigned to us. But a majority of them aren't those people.
Explain what realignment is.
Realignment in 2011, the state basically made parolees and certain felon offenders the county's responsibility instead of the state's responsibility. So we got about two-thirds of the people that used to go to parole that are now county probation's and the jail's responsibility to house and supervise within the community. Felons.
Okay. But you're saying the vast majority are not?
Not the ones living behind the mall, mm-hmm. and not, you know, there are a couple of them out there, certainly, that are committing crimes and may be homeless out there. Most of our guys are couch surfing, and they know, you know, where they can go and get shelter with other like people. They tend to be fairly well connected.
It's an interesting problem, and a problem that has, it's really all over the place, but...
Can I add something?
Please do.
I just want to say that... this time of year, we also have a lot of folks that come here and are encouraged to come here by hopes of making fast money, harvesting and trimming. And so every year we have an influx of mostly young folks, but people who are, you know, engaged in the industry. And simultaneously, while we as a community are in many ways financially intertwined and some would say dependent upon the industry, there's also a lot of judgment about it and about the folks that are coming in. My washing machine is broken, and so I was at Emerald City in Arcata on the weekend, which is usually a pretty quiet and very clean place, which is why I like to take my laundry there. And on that day it was packed with folks that it was pretty obvious had come in from wherever they're working, and they needed to get clean and they needed to wash their clothes and just like anybody else. But the comments that I was hearing in the laundromat and even feeling myself, it's like, oh, there's all these people and now my clothes are going to smell like weed and all of that. And then I was out on the plaza and just hearing people talk about all these homeless people and that something really terrible was happening because now we have the plaza is taken over without seeming to connect with there's multiple things going on. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, this time of year, we have a lot of extra people that do not have a house because they're here working. And if we thought of them more, I don't know if this would help people, but they're really kind of migrant workers.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I just think it sort of confuses and exacerbates people's bias about the homeless situation, because we have people that are a part of our community pretty permanently that are without homes. And as Nezzy was saying, no opportunity to have shelter or to have a shower or the kind of basic stuff and a place to sleep. And then there's the influx of additional people. And then I think the community gets really confused. And
looks like we've got someone who wants to get in on the conversation. So if you can put your headphones on, and we'll go to line one. Hello, you're on the air here on KHUM. Hello? Hello?
Hi.
Yes. You're on the air.
So I was just calling in response to, she was just talking about Emerald City Laundromat, and I live here in downtown Arcata, and uh-huh. I've had that experience as well. Walking down the street with my laundry in a backpack. And I think if someone wants to take themselves out of that other, or, you know, out of your regular day-to-day life and put yourself in that other position for a second, that's kind of a good experience, because mm-hmm. I've gotten some really weird looks before walking down the street with my laundry in my big backpacking backpack. And it's like, suddenly mm-hmm. I'm a different person. I'm not part of this community. I'm in that other, and it's really not a fun... Mm-hmm. Not a fun place to be.
Yeah, and I hope I didn't sound like I was in a judgment place.
No, not at all. I'm saying I've mm-hmm. been, you know, I've felt, I think if anyone wants to try to experience that other position, mm-hmm. they should just walk down the street in Arcata with a backpack on their bag.
Yeah.
On their back, because they'll get some weird looks.
That's right, and people actually say very derogatory things.
Oh, yeah.
Just for somebody trying to wash their clothes. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to step this up a bit and talk about the response of people, not just making comments to individuals, but the movements in cities about taking our town back that have mm-hmm. been organized against people that are on the street or living outdoors. It's very aggressive, and it is clearly a demonstration that they are seeing people as a we and they, and not able to see or sort out the varying elements of what that is, and sort of treat people in a very block kind of way. And not, if you can't see their humanity, you cannot also see then the things that they're dealing with or what's their circumstances.
I'd like to actually get into that a little bit more if we could. And I think we need to take a quick break. Caller, thank you so much for calling in with your comments.
Yeah, thanks for holding this panel, because I think this is what we need, is just more people talking openly about it. So thank you.
Bet. You
thank
bet.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. So, again, the phone number is 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. You can also email in any thoughts or questions, studio@khum.com. We do need to take a quick break, and we'll continue this conversation here on KHUM right after this. All right, it is 8:42, and you've got it on KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, our 20th, and we're dealing with privilege, prejudice, power, and the violence of otherism. And otherism is the topic that we're really focusing on at the moment, specifically the homeless. One of the things that was just mentioned was sort of an us and them attitude. Take back our city, kind of a combative viewpoint, rather than how can we work to help people. These are our fellow human beings, our fellow citizens, and you know, they too have rights. They are members of our society. They may not have the privilege that we were talking about of having a large enough income, or having a nice place to live, or a nice car to drive.
Right. A lot of the behaviors that people are condemned for or criticized for are behaviors that many people who have privilege are engaged in too, but they're behind walls and doors and can't be seen. And
it makes it very difficult for people to have any kind of a humane experience when they have to live in public. You know, the city of Eureka has just passed an ordinance related to nudity, and some of the claims on that when people came before the political body was that it was another way of trying to get to the residents who have to live outside because they have to bare their genitals publicly in order to urinate or defecate because they have no place to go. And it's a really graphic example of how we have taken things to the – even in conceptualizing it.
Well, here's the interesting thing is people are very against public restrooms because they don't want – they don't want homeless people using these public restrooms. Well, if there is no public restroom, human beings have to eliminate at some point. Yeah. It's just part of being a human.
Technology.
You cannot just keep it in.
Yeah.
Not possible.
We've asked in good faith to have things like porta potties and hygiene stations and dumpsters made available so that people could actually be more self-reliant and have some of their basic needs met and realize that people actually care.
You know, it's kind of an interesting thing. You know, a lot of people really enjoy the play Les Miserables. And if you look at that, this is, you know, the story of, you know, of a poor man who steals a loaf of bread to survive and, you know, is hunted to the ends of the earth, you know, Jean Valjean. And, and it's like, yeah, it's kind of where we are here. It's just not quite as romanticized because it's just Eureka.
And no expense would be spared in tracking him down. Mm-hmm. So the amount of money that goes into sort of this keeping us in this caste system. I mean, really, if you don't have a job or two jobs or three jobs so that you can have a place – and you're not contributing sort of to the profit margin, then you do not have the right to be safe. You do not have the right to actually survive and live. And that's casting into a system whole groups of people who keep falling into that. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, oh, that group is getting smaller. That group is getting bigger, larger. And in here, affordable housing, I mean, you can't hardly rent a place unless you're going to live with a bunch of people and share rooms and spaces and little spaces in places that aren't that safe. You're not going to be able to even rent a place, let alone ever hope to buy a house.
Well, and even though the economy is at this point turning around, it turns around from the top down. And so, you know, if you're at the bottom of the scale, it has not turned around yet at all.
And currently, I mean, this isn't theoretical. This is real. We can go out and we can watch this happening right now in the green belts around Eureka, in the marsh in particular. And the strategy there is what's being called incremental enforcement. And so little by little by little, the strategy is to reduce the footprint to the extent that they just compress people to the extent that they can't be there healthy, they can't be there, they have to go someplace else, and now they have to be leaving the area for other reasons to be doing cleanup, and they're removing, you know, construction materials and that kind of stuff, but also they're going to be spraying invasive species that will not allow people to be there, and they're going to have to go someplace to sleep because they can't be there, and there's no place for them to go.
So let's take a look at, you know, this is not just a problem here, it's a problem everywhere, and in every country. And other countries have dealt with this in different ways. I visited Thailand in 1990. That was a wonderful trip. And one thing that I thought was fascinating is the way they dealt with the homeless population is there was a huge swath of land that was pretty much theirs. And the homeless set up their own community. And, you know, this was not palatial living by any means, you know, but they had their own place and they had a sense of community. And, you know, they were not being, you know, pushed out of there on a regular basis. This is a place that they could at least be when they were completely down on their luck, when they're at the very bottom of the economic scale.
Well, I'd like to say that in terms of a sense of community, the people that are in the marsh definitely have a sense of community there, and it's maybe a few different communities that are there, and there are certainly those that are otherizing the people that are out there while they're there that are criminals and are preying on
people mm-hmm. that are vulnerable. And a lot of the people that are out there are very vulnerable because of mental illness and sure. because of having also addictions or, you know, alcoholism and disabilities. There's lots of people with disabilities. I guess what I'm trying to say in this is the community is the best part of all of that. People right. know how to be in community. And that's kind of what AHA has been trying to help foster is you if you have an alternate place where people can go to be safe and legal, you take the best part of community and you help that flourish and let mm-hmm. people grow from there. We don't have any programs, none, that allow someone to begin where they are and work from there. We right. have demands that we say you have to do this within 30 days or this within so long. And we set up conditions that make it difficult for people to be successful.
Right.
And that informal helping that just naturally comes from people who are sharing a space and place. A student in class yesterday was talking about an encampment in San Jose that actually got literally bulldozed. But before that, where if somebody needed, you know, they were going to go try to find a job, then someone was going to watch her kids, that there was just this natural way of like supporting each other and sharing food and sharing whatever little minimal resources that folks had. So given that, why is it that we're not helping to support that kind of a model?
These are conversations that I have all the time. I had one the other day with our police chief, Andy Mills. There are people, young people, who are living out there that would like to work. They would like to do things. Other cities, Albuquerque being one, has taken people that are houseless and who need jobs or something to do to, you know, improve their circumstance, and have started picking them up in vans and taking them to places that the city wants work done and letting them work for a day. I think the day is like 5 hours long. Could we not do something like that? Would you be willing to give up a few of your Measure Z funds to foster a program to help this happen? And I've talked to the mayor about having employment kinds of programs. Many people who are out there, I think this is what we don't understand. There are a lot of chronically homeless people in Humboldt County. That means they've been out there for a year to 3 years or more. They're not easily going to come inside. Some will never come inside. And there are lots of reasons why that is. Some people who've been institutionalized, having been in prison, having been in the military, having been in a mental institution, there's a lot of resistance in those circumstances. But that doesn't mean that they can't work. And so there are lots of societies who know people are drunks. They're going to be drunks. They're not going to try and make them be sober, but they're going to give them meaningful things to do. So there are some societies where they'll start them out in the morning, give them a couple of beers. They'll do their work. They'll have a break. They'll have a couple more beers. They'll do a little bit more, and then their day's over. And they are managing to be productive members of society. And what we don't allow, we have to figure out a way to let people help and participate in the ways that they can, rather than saying if they can't participate this way, then they can't be part of what we're doing.
I mean, the reality is there are homeless people that do cause problems, that are criminals, that, you know, but there are a lot that don't, that are just, there's nothing else to do. It is criminal to be homeless. And if you do not want homeless people encamped in your doorway, if you do not want them camping out in a place that you think is beautiful and pristine, and then there has to be some place to go. I mean, there has to be an alternative. And I think there's probably a lot of people who are listening to this right now, whose eyes are opening probably for the first time, going, I never thought of that. Because it's like, if there is no avenue, what's left? I mean, that's the thing. If there's no alternative to, you know, sleeping out, you know, behind the mall or encamped in a doorway or under an overpass or something like that, what else is there?
Right. It just keeps people down. And even in our criminal justice system, we have a homeless court that we develop. And I think it was a great idea because we have these folks that continue to get these municipal code violations for camping outdoors and urinating outdoors and and this and that and the other thing, and they can never get out from under that. Mm-hmm. And the homeless court really provides them an opportunity to get those cases dismissed. They go out and do some community service work, and it pays off all the fines that are related to those quote-unquote crimes and allows them to get out from under and improve their situation. Doesn't solve all the issues that Nezzy's talking about. I mean, it's not providing them housing, sure. But at least there are people that are connected to that program where there is some inreach by community-based organizations like Betty Chin and all of that, just helping people if they're ready, because, I mean, we all make our changes when we're ready and when we're uncomfortable being the way we've been. That's when we start making change, and it provides an opportunity for people to lift themselves up.
But there does have to be that opportunity.
If there's a pathway.
Yeah.
Right.
When it's illegal to exist.
Yeah.
it's hard.
Earlier, Cliff, you said something about messages that we grow up with, like that, you know, if you just work hard, then good things come to you.
Sure.
And I think that's where a lot of judgment comes in, is when if you see somebody who appears to be homeless or on the edge of that, that there's assumptions made that if they just get their act together in whatever that is, work harder, don't have an addiction, don't have a mental health issue, you know, all the things. And yet, A, that's not true, that hard work necessarily brings all good things in an economy like we have. It's not just about an ailing economy, but the way that resources are dispersed. And then if you add other factors like a mental health issue or an addiction and you don't have opportunities for treatment or support, then it's not about if I just try harder. You know, there has to be something there for the person. And I want to say that in terms of sense of community, one of the things that's really struck me when we have someone we're serving that is maybe chronically homeless, and maybe we've been at the hospital with them for an exam after a sexual assault, and looking for a place for them to be. And imagine going through a sexual assault and having no warm or comfortable or safe place. And I have been in situations where, as we're thinking about shelter, the person has said, I just want you to drop me off at, and they name some place, and maybe this is 3 a.m. And it's a hard feeling as an advocate to think, oh, I'm just going to drop someone off on a corner. But what has been said is that this is where I feel safe because I have my people. Mm-hmm. And it's the sense of community that, as someone who's not homeless and has never had to experience that, for me it would be like, oh, gosh, don't just get dropped off on a corner. But for the person who knows where their safety is and where their community is, it's home. You know, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying therefore it's great, but of the options available, which are close to zero, then being with the people that you know and the people who might be kind to you.
Yeah, it's the people who accept you and understand you.
Yeah. And so that's just a good reminder for all of us. We all might have a community that we feel a part of, and so do folks that don't have homes.
And there's also a cause and effect thing to look at as well. It is certainly true that there are people that that have mental health issues that have become homeless because of that. Mm-hmm. But there is also if you are persecuted for living, if you are persecuted for just doing what it takes to survive over and over and over and over again, that is going to prey on your mental health. And
make you crazy.
It absolutely will. I mean,
and
if you're
sad
if you are treated like a criminal depressed. Constantly, when you know you're not a criminal, it'll wear you down.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and it's something that we really need to look at.
Interesting thing about community, and we're all part of one somewhere or many maybe, but one of the things that is a conundrum, because I would love to figure out. Love to figure it out. We all need to work together to figure this out and to make it real. But in reality, everybody wants
pretty much the same thing. They Absolutely. Want a solution to this extreme situation we have. They want people to have some place to go. Some of them just want them to go away, but they want to have some place for them to go. And really, we aren't operating at that level. We've turned a lot of the authority of dealing with this over to law enforcement, and the city has made decisions about that, and we have money to support that, and so we get sort of de facto social workers right. in law enforcement.
The fact is, no one likes it. Yeah. No one likes it. No, you know, people who have homes who see homeless encampments don't like it. People who are homeless don't like it. They don't like what's going on. No one likes it. But at this point, a solution has not been looked at yet.
No, but people are being very aggressive
yes.
in the way they don't like it. And so political officials who are making decisions in trying to help the situation and give people some of what they want, you know, clean, this is our town, let's fix it.
Yep.
And for people that are out there not having a place to go, well, let's just do this for now. It's otherizing everybody.
Right. You know, I think if everyone steps back and looks at this as a human situation and not a problem of the other, if we can just sweep them away, make them go away, if we can look at, you know, our own brethren in the community, how can we make this a better situation for everyone? I think everybody wins. Question is how.
I would agree.
Well, it isn't just about making it better. Actually, I have a grave concern right now that we are tromping over the rights of people. And that's a huge thing, because when you bulldoze someone's property or you take their property away, it may only just be a tent if you're the worker mm-hmm. who's doing that. But that's their property.
That's all they have.
And but people have protection under mm-hmm. the law. And we are moving around these things in a way that we should be very concerned.
That's a good point.
When we come back after break, I want to talk about the attempt at least to rapid rehouse some small percentage of people.
Excellent. All right, you've got it on KHUM, Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and McKinleyville, and streaming on the web at khum.com. It is our 20th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We are dealing today with privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you certainly can at 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. All right, you've got it on KHUM. We're about 5 minutes after 9 o'clock into our second hour of our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And this is our 20th, our first of three roundtable discussions. And we are dealing with privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism. And taking center stage for the past 20 minutes or so has been the homeless situation. Let's resume our conversation. So where were we?
We were talking about everybody really wanting the same thing, mm-hmm. but not being able to get on some common ground about how we can actually solve the issues that we have. And
right.
it requires a large conversation involving the cities, the counties, the municipalities, mm-hmm. everybody, because not one community can fix this. Eureka
sure.
is not the city to fix everything.
No. And it may be the largest in Humboldt County, yeah. but it's not that large.
Right.
And the thing is, I think one thing that will at least move the conversation forward is to stop the dehumanization of people who are homeless. It's very easy to turn a blind eye and just say, oh, those people, you know, when you're just not thinking of them as people.
Well, and one simple thing that we could all do is think about how the language that we use. Instead of the homeless, we could say people living without houses or people living without shelter. It's extra words, but it's in that extra word that we give a thought about people who are living without shelter, because that's the actual truth. Mm-hmm. Instead of the homeless, which is like a category or a, you know, the cast.
You know, it's kind of interesting. One thing that you mentioned, and I've thought of that every time I've seen these pictures of these roundups of these encampments, is the property that is being confiscated and mm-hmm. thrown away. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, things like market baskets, that doesn't count. But there are things that are yeah. people's personal property that are being confiscated and thrown away simply because they are living someplace that is not sanctioned.
The city of Fresno, city of Fresno versus Kincaid, or Kincaid versus the city of Fresno, settled a very large lawsuit in favor of those without homes because of the destruction of their property. And all that funding went to the people that didn't have a place to go, which was a good thing. But, people here will maintain that that doesn't happen. People's property doesn't get taken.
It does.
Certainly it does. And there are people right now who are having to deal with that as we speak, probably. So
We had an email contribution.
Good.
And so let me go ahead and read this email from Desiree. Hello, K-Hum. I just wanted to share the frustration that I experience when discussing with people about homeless issue. Majority of the people will automatically make judgments and assume that they are somehow responsible for their homelessness. Every time this comes up, I experience a flashback from an ingrained image of a picture from the Great Depression out of a history book when I went to elementary school. This picture was a homeless camp. The feelings it brings up is sadness and confusion. I feel like in some sense people are saying these things or dehumanizing them as a way to set aside the feelings that this brings up to justify the complex problem. Mm-hmm. And another thought, I wonder how back in the Great Depression the homeless people were socially viewed.
Best, well, Desiree.
I can say, having my family origins being people who were moving during the Dust Bowl from Oklahoma to Oregon and Washington, they were viewed terribly, and they were treated terribly. And in a similar way, it was a time of such hardship for so many people that, it's that pushing down one against another. And so if you happen to be people that were needing to flee the Dust Bowl and move, you were kind of viewed as the worst of the worst, or the lazy people. And actually, they'd been very hardworking farmers who had to work very, very hard to move somewhere else and reestablish themselves, possibly again as farmers. And so I think I think part of it, to me, is if you view someone as less than, and an example is this idea of the property they have, I think part of the rationalization of being able to take and destroy their things is that we're already thinking of them as people who don't have anything. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't have anything, then this stuff is not actually their property, when of course it is. But if you're thinking of them as people without anything, it's easy to take and demolish, because what does it matter? They already have nothing. And that's a way of ensuring that they have nothing. And if you have nothing, it's pretty hard to work your way out of that situation.
Well, here's an interesting thing also, is that another falsehood is that everyone who is homeless has no job. That is not true.
No, certainly not.
That is
not
absolutely
true.
Not true. Right. There are plenty of people who are working who are not making enough money to rent a place to live. As Sherry mentioned, it's renting here is pretty expensive.
Well, we even have university students.
Absolutely. I've had plenty of my own who couch surf.
Yeah.
Don't have a place to live.
Exactly. And so people think of, oh, if they're a student, then, they're in a privileged group, and in one way, yes, but in another, if you don't have a place to live, how is it that you're going to maintain being a student? And that brings them into all kinds of situations that are probably not going to be really safe. And that's why a number of students end up living, for example, in grow houses and trading their labor for a roof over their head. And then what we hear about at Rape Crisis is the sexual exploitation that happens in those situations. And, I'm not taking any position about marijuana, just to say that, like any industry, there is exploitation. And I think we turn a blind eye to the many, many students who are barely hanging on by their fingernails.
Sure.
We just assume that if you're in college that things must be good for you.
Well, you mentioned the trimming scene, and you know, we might as well bring that up at this point. We have in the past, and you know, the fact that it is illegal at this point adds to the isolation. And when there is that kind of isolation, it's just a recipe for abuse.
Right.
And you know, one thing that we can say, whether you're pro or against legalization, when that does happen, when this is more out in the open and legal, at least that will be probably a little less prevalent, I would hope, anyway.
Create an opportunity for more safety.
Yes.
Yeah, I fear it will turn into a different form of exploitation of large corporations. And, you know, so we'll have to watch that carefully. And as a community, be willing to engage in keeping our eyes wide open to how all these things play out and not pretending like it's not going on, because that's what's happening now.
Sure.
Is just pretending. And, you know, that could carry over throughout legalization.
And I appreciate people bringing up the Dust Bowl situation and the Great Depression, because really there was a solution at that time, and the New Deal really was a solution. It made people productive. It gave them jobs. It let them form their own communities. Yes, they were homeless for a while, but then they were able to get to work, and they actually created some humongous infrastructure for the United States, which is another issue that we hear about right now.
Sure, we have a lot of infrastructure problems.
And perhaps we could
do the same.
Revisit that program. It's certainly time to reconsider what has worked in the past.
Absolutely, and it worked well. I mean, there was you take a look at some of the WPA projects that were done in the 30s. You know, to this day, some of the most stunning things you see out there as far as infrastructure go.
And infrastructure is crumbling.
It is.
I just want to chime in here about privilege, because when we're talking about the Dust Bowl and people being displaced because of the economics of that time, you know, we only need to look in our recent history in areas fairly nearby where 13,000 people were taken care of very quickly when their homes caught on fire and they were dislocated. And because they had possessions, because they had a place to be, they were offered assistance, funding streams applied to them, and it made it possible, you know, in emergent situations to do something. That's a really good example of how we can have the same number of people or a lot of people in any given area that don't have that are in being displaced. They don't have a place to go, and there's nothing for them.
Well, I think there is an attempt, at least through Redwood Community Action Agency Multiple Assistance Center, which was a pretty successful program for families who were a variety of reasons unable to have permanent housing, and then they were living in a situation where there was a program that really sort of addressed the issues that kept them from being permanently housed. Well, that program no longer exists. And so now the intention is that the problem is that if you're without a house for a period of time, that's what leads to the chronic homelessness and exacerbates all of the issues that have people find themselves without homes. So now the idea is rapid rehousing, that if you can get somebody into a house pretty quickly, that at least that is going to be one attempt to solve the situation. That's for a small percentage of people. And then I'm not sure how they're going to address the severe health problems that people will bring in, the mental health issues that people live with, the other kinds of lack of opportunity and problems that have kept people from being permanently housed. That's a difficult thing in terms of the rapid rehousing. So I don't know that much about that.
Well, what they find out, though, I think the evidence is pretty clear that once they get the people stabilized with a roof over their head, that they utilize those really expensive services less. So emergency room visits go down. The long-term medical problems get less severe, and they actually impact the criminal justice system less as well. I mean, they become stabilized. Everybody needs a basic support, a safe place to be, and just minimal stuff to keep us going.
And one thing, Nancy, that you brought up was the fire and people's homes and the outpouring. The thing is that people at the bottom of the strata don't have a big voice. Mm-hmm. So it is very tough. First of all, they're invisible. And second of all, without the power of having someone to lobby on your behalf, you don't have much of a voice, and it's really difficult. And in order to make this kind of movement, it's going to take people in power, people with privilege, to actually care about people at the bottom, and that's really the way it's going to work without a revolution.
And to have the kind of conversations that Desiree was talking about when she engages in those conversations, and people have that way of protecting themselves by blaming the people who are suffering.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that protects me from having that uncomfortable feeling of empathy, of saying, oh, because I know when I think of that, not me personally, but I know that many of us would think, and maybe me, I think, I would get two jobs. I would work really hard. I would, But the thing
is
that,
do.
Well, yeah, and they do, and they still, you get down to where you don't have any more options, you don't have any more resources, and maybe that's what separates the privileged from the lack of privilege, is when there are no more options.
Mm-hmm. And to go back to what you said, Cliff, about needing people in other places who can do something about it, the leadership or whomever. That's all very important, but for most people who don't have a lot of options, when they get an opportunity to attempt to be systematized to get some of the things that they need, they can't do that independently. They need somebody to walk them through and be a case manager or to help them get through that in order to
absolutely
do that. And we have a sore lack of that mm-hmm. all right. the way around. And
well, so, we have got, you take a look at the establishment of CASA, which is a child's voice in court. And that was that's a terrific thing because, you're dealing with small children who don't have the wherewithal to defend themselves in the legal situation. And, it's a terrific organization. And it would be wonderful to have some kind of advocacy, for people at the bottom of the strata. As you said, helping them through the system, because it can be very complicated to navigate it.
There are advocates out there, but I want to make something really clear. You can have a lot of people who are very friendly and want to help and want to do really good, but you need trained people who understand how to work with people with mental illness
absolutely.
Or with really serious issues in order
and disability.
Yeah, in order for that to work. So there's a difference between advocates and
help.
Yeah.
Hands-on help.
Yeah.
And I think Betty Quinn is an excellent
Betty Quan Chin
mm-hmm. Is an excellent example of one person who is doing something, has done something, has persisted in doing something, and is making a difference.
Absolutely.
And she will be our keynote speaker on November 20th at the Healing Breakfast at the Eureka Women's Club.
And this is, people who often say, what can one person do? Take a look at what she's done. I mean, it's remarkable. And especially if you look at her upbringing, which is just unbelievable, and where she's come from and where she's at now and what she is doing every day. It's just, she's inspirational. I'm really glad that she's going to be our keynote coming up on the 20th. And it's going to be fantastic.
And we all can do something. I take a lesson from my daughter, who is in a situation where she was trying to figure out, how can I be of help? And there was... it seemed like there were no good options. And then she turned to me and she said, well, if nothing else, I can be kind. And that's something that I bring to lots of presentations that Rape Crisis does, when people are feeling like, what can I do when I know a child's in danger, but I don't have proof? Or what can I do when I see this person on the street and I don't know what to do? Well, in all those situations, if nothing else, we can be kind. And kindness includes seeing people as whole human beings. And kindness is not turning away and taking that moment to see someone rather than protect ourselves from having to see. And we all do that. I do that. I've turned away from something that is painful and I don't want to see. And if we can own that and maybe in another moment instead turn towards a human being or other living beings, then, you know, that could make a big difference.
And letting acts of kindness inspire us. And coming out of Costco parking lot and seeing that a woman had two bags of one was dog food, I'm sure, for the person who was standing there with a cardboard sign, and another bag of food. And she just quietly just dropped those and handed them to the person and then went on her way. Mm-hmm. That was one act of kindness. Mm-hmm. And those acts are meaningful.
And we all need them. Because the other part of it that can be tricky is if I convince myself, oh, I'm a kind person, and I will do this nice thing for this other. If I'm still seeing them as less than,
right,
then it's not really kindness. And so like what you're describing is in a quiet way of actually offering and giving without wanting anything from it, that to me is genuine. And as long as we're not seeing ourselves as somehow above someone else.
Absolutely.
Constant challenge.
Yeah. And I've got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to take a look at different layers of privilege, because, you know, you think of privilege, it's like, oh, that's the rich guy with the Rolls Royce is making six figures. That's one layer of privilege. There's many strata of privilege that we need to look at.
There's lots of groups. Betty Chin is a good example of that. That has done a great deal. Is it on? Oh. Mm-hmm. Betty Chin is a really good example of someone who's done an amazing thing. She also has tremendous support, yep, of the community, and a lot of dollars flow in that direction. And if there's going to be an opportunity, it's going to go to Betty and her programming. There are lots of other groups that are working, mm-hmm, you know, by shoestrings trying to help people and are doing great work also. And I don't want mm-hmm, to not acknowledge,
of course,
PAR, absolutely, and CHILL and other organizations that have, yeah, spent a lot of time trying to help.
And we need to give some of them some, yeah, some light as well.
Yeah.
But we got to take a quick break. You've got it on KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We are looking at privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism. And we are pretty much down to our last half hour, as incredible as that may seem. And if you would like to get in on the conversation, you certainly can. 786-KHUM, that's 786-5486. If you'd like to email a question or comment, studio@khum.com. It is 28 minutes after 9. You've got it on KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, our 20th. And we're in the last part of our first two-hour call-in panel. And again, I encourage you to be part of the conversation. 786-KHUM, that's 786-5486. You can also send in an email, studio@khum.com. I think it's time we went around the room and introduced ourselves again. My co-host, Sherry Johnson.
I am Sherry Johnson, and this is our 20th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing radio education campaign. I'm the director of field education in the Department of Social Work and a board member for the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council. And to my left,
Nezzy Wade, and I am on the board for Affordable Homeless Housing Alternatives and currently on the Human Rights Commission. And I was a colleague of Sherry's at the university for quite some time.
And this is Paula Arrowsmith Jones with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team, and I'd like to give out our crisis line numbers.
Please.
If I can. Our 24-hour number in Del Norte County is 707-465-2851, and here in Humboldt, that 24-hour line is 707-445-2881.
And I'm Bill Damiano. I'm the Chief Probation Officer for the County of Humboldt, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Domestic Violence Coordinating Council here in Humboldt County.
Excellent. And speaking of the phone number, we also have an interactive help site at our website at khum.com. Click on the Stop the Violence logo, and at the very top there is this really nice little graphic. You can click on that, and it'll ask you a series of questions and point you in the right direction and get you some phone numbers. So
great.
That's there to help folks out. So we were talking a little bit about the different strata of privilege. And there's There's so many different layers of it. You know, I was talking about the people at the very top. You think of that, but we all have some kind of privilege. Most of us do. I mean, I think everyone in this room has mm-hmm. some kind of a privilege, and we've got jobs. We're white.
Mm-hmm. White skin privilege.
White skin privilege is huge.
I was raised by someone who grew up in China, so for all intents and purposes, that was my cultural background. So, but I look like I'm a non-Chinese person.
Mm-hmm. You do. That would be your passing fare.
Right. But yes, that white skin privilege is just as important as anybody who looks like they're not a person of color. And light skin is something that is an issue as well. Somehow lighter skin, even as a person of color, you're less discriminated against. So there's this white supremacy kind of ideology mm-hmm. that we all benefit from, even if it's an ugly concept.
And, I was talking to a man the other day who identifies as a male, as a man, as white, and has stuff, has resources. And we were talking about privilege, and it became clear in the conversation that part of the struggle for him was that if he looks at those layers of privilege, he feels guilty. And when one feels guilty, that can lead to shame and then to not looking at things. So our conversation was about, he was born as a white-skinned guy and in a family that had the resources that he had the privilege of college and all those things, paid for without having to incur huge debt. So those are all things that he can recognize and notice. But going to the guilt place isn't really helpful. And I think it interferes, or people will say, well, it's not my fault what my great-great-grandfather did. True. And what are you doing now? Because if you just stay in the, so I don't want to look at that because then I'll feel bad, it's just not helpful to the people that are suffering on the other side
sure.
of it.
But may drive someone to do something for the wrong reason and never get it.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Right. And, the guilt can push you in two different directions. And but you have to acknowledge that the privilege is there, that, may not be in a terrific situation. You may not have a great job. You may even be homeless. But if you're white, you do have a leg up on your brethren
of
color.
The thing about privilege is that you don't have to acknowledge that you have privilege. That's right. The privilege part.
Right.
You don't have to think about, how other people experience life, the same life, mm-hmm. when you're the subject.
And the thing is, in Humboldt County, I've lived in many other places throughout this country, and this is the whitest community I've ever lived in mm-hmm. in my life. But with that said, that almost kind of exacerbates the situation for those who are of color, because if you are of color, you stand out from the crowd, mm-hmm. and it can be an issue.
Well, the horrendous experiences of students who come to Humboldt State University who are of color, who can't shop in a store without being followed, or
exactly.
where people might call things out from a vehicle. I mean, if you're African American, you've grown up in a predominantly African American community, that's a different kind of experience than coming here and really being sort of objectified mm-hmm. In a way that you had not experienced.
We can talk about that, what's happening right here in this community and the community just up the road with racial profiling for the Latinos.
Absolutely.
And that is a real good example of otherizing. I'm on the Human Rights Commission, and we do these tabling experiences. And recently at LatinoNet, people visited our table and shared experiences about what that's like in store shopping and having bought groceries and then
left them there to go back and get one more item. And when they retrieve their groceries, being accused of stealing and that, you know, labeling people as Mexicans coming in just to steal. That's current. That's something that's happening now.
Oh, absolutely. And I've talked with several people who have been, whenever they go shopping, are followed, assuming that they're going to steal something.
And let's not forget that part of why we're such a white community is the near just complete annihilation of Native communities.
Well, yeah.
I mean, and except that we're blessed to have as many tribes and the largest population here on Native land.
Yeah, I'm not discounting that. But
And of course,
the majority of the populations were decimated.
And the Chinese expulsion. Can't forget about that. I mean, there's a long, long history of
it. There's a reason why it's mostly white. And I'd like to, you know, we partner closely with HSU and have very positive relationships with the university, so I don't want to damage that. But I would like to just sort of call them out a little bit, that when you go to Southern California recruiting students talking about the diversity of Humboldt State University, it would be helpful to say, actually, you bring the diversity.
You bring the diversity.
If you don't come, there is no diversity. Because I think that there's facts that are either left out altogether or not shown in its full picture of it. And because I hear from students all the time that they had no idea how white this community was. And it causes them to feel like they can't go off campus, or they can't, even on campus, that there's only safe pockets of other students, mostly other students of color, because they don't know what might happen.
Because if you are of color in Humboldt County, you stand out.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, for better or for worse, you do. And it can make someone feel uncomfortable.
Well, in the business part of the university is brought 1,000 more students onto campus, and that is definitely exceeding capacity and infrastructure. So that the sort of the business of putting sort of money before the meeting the needs of all people is just infiltrated on so many different levels. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to mention too that another terrible. Example of this is the for-profit colleges that have sprung up, where people are granted these huge sums of money that they can borrow, but without either an accredited education or an adequate education to be able to ever pay back those loans. Mm-hmm. So supporting predatory predation of education even has really set many, many people up for suffering for many years, because they will never pay those loans back and they will never be able to get a job that could enable them to pay those loans back. So that isn't a way to solve the inequity of economic situations. That's not going to be a survivable kind of solution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And kind of an interesting thing about being of color in this community. Even people who are well-meaning have assumptions. And I've got a young woman, I'll leave her name out of this, who is of Asian descent. I was born here in Arcata. Okay. She works at a retail outlet and has on many occasions had people say, "Oh, you speak English really well." Well, what is your accent from, Arcata?
I just want to say, "Dui buchi." That means I am very sorry that happened to you.
And it's kind of like it annoys the crap out of her. It was like, I think she's more American than I am. I'm only a second generation American. Yes, but you know, it's like, but I don't have any features that show that I'm from anywhere else.
I think that makes the point. This whole conversation makes the point that Bill said when we were on break, which is that the more isolated you are, and we are as a rural Northern California county, the easier it is to otherize.
Mm-hmm. Right?
You know,
well,
yeah.
Even just from a larger context in the United States, it's not been that long that as a culture, you know, we haven't been that far from aristocracy. I mean, the people that came to America really were here to get away from that, and the people that were landowners were privileged and white. We invited a lot of different cultures here, and I think that it's been a good experiment. Maybe we made more progress than some other places a little quicker. We have a long way to go, but the point I wanted to make and the point I made over break was that the culture, you know, was more family centric. We had extended generations living together, so we had a lot of supports. We felt more community. And now we're in a place where people, you know, even the nuclear family is broken up and people are really isolated, and it's so much easier for people to otherize when you're all alone. You know, mm-hmm. you don't feel connected to anything. And I think social media, you know, Nezzy was kind of touching on it earlier. Social media allows people to do that as well, because you're making comments about things without an immediate response from someone. It makes it really easy to make mm-hmm. rude, inappropriate comments, mm-hmm. you know, that you wouldn't say. Well, maybe you would. hopefully you wouldn't say to somebody's face, and I think those are things that we need to address. But the good news is that there are models out there that can break down barriers and create community. LatinoNet, that Nezzy mm-hmm. was mentioning, is one example of that.
Promotores.
And every year they've had the Festejandro gathering, and they've had more and more people coming and more businesses and organizations participating, and it's inviting those people that are in our community to be more accepted and to feel a part of. And you know, the campaigns to get rid of people or reclaim our town, it's like, well, how about redefine our town? Mm-hmm. The people mm-hmm. are our town. Criminals, offenders are our family members and citizens, as you were mentioning before, Cliff. The homeless or the houseless people are our citizens. They live here. They're part of our community. We can either bring them in and help them support our vision for our community, you know? I think that that's the best solution. Otherizing them just exacerbates the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Just kicks it down the road for and makes things worse. All right, we've got to take a quick break once again. You've got it on KHUM. It is our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. Privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism is what we are looking at. And if you would like to get in on the conversation, we're getting down to the wire. 786-KHUM, that's 786-5486, studio at KHUM.com, if you'd like to send in a question. Okay, we're about 14 minutes away from 10 o'clock, and you've got it on KHUM. It's our 20th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, and we are dealing this week and during this roundtable discussion with privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism. And it's kind of hard to believe, but we're getting down to the wire at this point. So we got to, if there are any things that we haven't touched on that need to get touched on, we should do that right away. Mezzy?
I want to touch on
something.
Yes. I'm a touchy-feely. I want to touch on some things.
Touch away.
Okay. Well, first of all, you know, we didn't really spend any time on solutions.
Right.
And we really need to focus a lot on the problem solving around this. And AHA has been promoting a number of solutions. Some we've been thinking of the more immediate solutions right now, but simple things, not just for us, but for the community. You know, we're talking about rapid rehousing and having spaces available, having something like going back to boarding houses and allowing that legally, you know, as an option.
It's not legal?
No.
It's regulated. I mean, they limit the number of people you can have in a house without mm-hmm. having a license. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, Nezzy, on November 19th, will you come back and talk with Cliff and just talk about solutions? Because that's the week in which we're celebrating allies and really talking about, you know, how we can address this issue of otherism.
What day of the week is that? Is a Thursday,
the day before the healing breakfast.
At same time, 8 to 10?
It will be 9 to 9:30, just a half an hour. But that would be great if you could just come and focus on solutions.
Bring solutions, yeah. Because that's that week, our last week, we focus on solutions.
Okay.
Thank you, Nezzy.
It's okay.
We need to talk about solutions every day,
actually. Yes, actually. They don't just happen when you schedule them. But I Also, Affordable Homeless Housing Alternatives is a developing nonprofit, and we are working on a variety of solutions that are some more immediate than others, like safe parking programs, for example. We meet the first Saturday of every month. There will be a meeting this Saturday from 12 to 2.
Where?
It's at the Jefferson Community Center, 1000 B Street. And we usually have a social time from 11:30 where we have some food and people to gather. And we have a regular agenda. We have a mailing list if you're interested. You can contact AHA at ahha.humco@gmail.com. And we can put you on that list.
And as I said before, I honestly do believe that because, pushing these people off to the side and otherizing them is really one of the last socially acceptable forms of this kind of otherizing. Yeah. And it is pretty socially acceptable right now. I think there's a lot of people who are listening to this who's, I'm hoping, whose eyes might have been open and gone, you know, I never thought of this before, but wow, this is really, there is no solution. We're putting people in a catch-22, where we're saying, don't do this. It's like saying, stop breathing. This is illegal.
And so we want to ask those people, we want to ask people who had any kind of, connection to this, that when you hear someone say something disparaging, when you hear someone, and it can be people in your family, it can be people in your neighbors, in your community, that you speak to that. And it doesn't mean, nobody likes to be, corrected and chastised and all of that. That's not, but to really, in an empathetic way, ask them to think about that.
Mm-hmm. And it's very popular right now to be otherizing. If you take a look at politics right now, you take a look at like Donald Trump and what has made him so popular is him otherizing everyone.
Except for him, he's great.
Like, wow. It's very easy to prop yourself up by putting everybody down, but it's very destructive.
Mm-hmm. Also, I just want to, for the sake of privilege, point out that we're all privileged. If you're listening to this program, you're listening probably because you have privilege and access to the airwaves and can listen. And there are lots of people that aren't going to hear this that I wish knew we were being compassionate and cared enough to have a program like this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's true.
And that well said. Well said. So while we are getting ready to wind this down, I think what we need to do is kind of go around the room and give some final thoughts on today's topic and as we move into it, next week's topic, because we're continuing it.
Let's start with Mr. Damiano.
Oh, boy. thanks.
Thanks.
Well, I think that I would just invite people to participate in their community and look for opportunities to have open, honest dialogue about the issues that are going on in our community. And I would ask them to go into those conversations with an eye towards solutions, thinking about how they can be a part of the solution, and to try and change the dialogue from me being different than someone else to imagine yourself as that person and how would you want to be treated if you were that person? What kinds of opportunities might you feel you would need and what would make a difference in your life?
Mm-hmm. And this is Paula, and I guess from the perspective of North Coast Rape Crisis Team, we'd want to remind people that imagine the communities we've been speaking of, those that are most marginalized, and now imagine that on top of that or as a part of that story is trauma and abuse and experiences of violation. And then imagine someone who is already marginalized and who is a trauma survivor trying to get needs met and what they might be facing in terms of access to services, access to anything that feels or looks like justice. If the community is already judging them on all these other layers, chances are they're not going to see anything that looks like justice. So we'd want to say to all folks out there who may have survived violence in their lives that our doors are open, our hotlines are open, and we see you, and we hear you, and we believe you.
Well said.
Thank you. I would speak from the point of view of AHA. Our motto, our tagline is safe, warm, and dry first, because we know that that's what people need in order.
And as explained, what the AHA acronym is.
Sorry. AHA stands for Affordable Homeless Housing Alternatives, and it's been around since a few years now. And it grew out of a grassroots effort to start addressing some of the need to educate, inform, and advocate for people that are living outdoors and have no resources, that are stigmatized, marginalized, and our vision is to have everybody have a safe place to be and to live. And the mission and how we accomplish that is by implementing a variety of alternatives, from sanctuary camps to tiny house villages to safe parking programs, youth camps, farm worker housing, all the kinds of things that would work in our community that would be really affordable, since we have no affordable housing.
I want to remind us that we are all connected, that people are related, and that we are, by our humanity, one people and one earth. And so with that again, just to engage in any kind of act of kindness and to put yourself in the place of what would that be like, and is there something I can do? Whatever it is I can do it. Do it. And then if this kind of way of thinking and also being, and you're considering going back to school, please visit the Department of Social Work's website for upcoming application due dates. And I mean, we're social work in the social change, social work kind of avenue. And if you want to just spend a couple of years or less or longer, because you can do it online as well, really delving into these issues and really becoming strengths-based and solution-focused, then I invite you to visit our website.
Excellent. And kind of my takeaway from this is it's very easy to be against things. But the question that I think everyone needs to ask is, what are you for? What do you stand for? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's a good takeaway from this, because it's very easy to be against the other. It's like, what are you doing for the other at this point?
Yeah, you know, the vision statement at North Coast Rape Crisis Team is imagine a world without violence. And we chose that because you have to imagine it before you can really vision it. Yep. And then create it and manifest it. And if we all did that, we'd be doing what you're suggesting, looking for being for something rather than against something.
Oh, absolutely. And next week, we're continuing this conversation.
But first, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Paulo. Thank you, Nezzy.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. And so next week, we will continue on. This is the first time we've ever just taken 2 weeks to...
On a topic.
To have these kind of conversations. So Tuesday through Thursday,
that
9
is right.
to 9:30. Cliff does interviews with a variety of people. Mm-hmm. Nezzy will be back on the 19th.
That's right.
And so, and then we really hope everyone will join us on November 20th, Friday, November 20th, 8 to 10 at the Eureka Women's Club for the 20th Healing Breakfast.
That is right. And as we said, next week the conversation continues. My guest on Tuesday is going to be a longtime friend of mine, Sam Ferguson. We actually met in radio. We've done radio for at the same places in Southern California and in San Francisco for a number of years. But aside from radio, Sam has always been a businessman. He's a very successful businessman. He's always driven very expensive cars, lives in very nice houses, lives on the water in San Francisco right now, in San Rafael, actually. And he's got one thing that separates him from a lot of other businessmen, that he is of color. He's black and has had unbelievable experiences while driving his Porsches, being pulled over several times, saying, "Where'd you steal that car?" Mm-hmm. And being cuffed for just walking down the street. This is a guy who dresses impeccably, And it's just kind of an interesting thing. And we'll bring his perspective in on this conversation on Tuesday as we continue our campaign.
And Wednesday, special guest to be announced. And Thursday will be Dr. Lauren Cannon. And he will be talking about sort of a philosophical view of all of these concepts, bias and prejudice, and being transgender.
That is right. And you know, talk about otherizing.
Yeah, that's right. And then we'll have a panel next Friday, 8 to 10 a.m. Confirmed guests so far, Christy Johnson and Gary Eagles, the superintendent of Humboldt County Office of Education.
That is right. So we are about to infringe on Bailey's time, so I am going to wrap it for today. This conversation, as all conversations on this campaign, will be archived at khum.com. Just click on the Stop the Violence logo. You can listen to it as a stream. You can download it, put it on your iPhone or whatever you would like. Anyway, we continue the conversation next week, and Bailey Brown is up next.